Listening to Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn, and tonight's episode is entitled Say It Ain't So, Joe Kennedy, and this is episode 96. And what we want to do tonight is just look at the dynamics of the Kennedy family. And the Kennedy family, to me, is one of those families that came to participate in the great experiment of the United States and had a success story, but unfortunately that success story ran afoul with somebody else's agenda, and that agenda is the globalist agenda, the global Zionist agenda that does not want nation states, that does not want rule of law other than their own Talmudic Noahide laws. And they have always seen the great experiment as being their biggest obstacle to their great work, as they call it, that static pyramid model with Jews ruling the world under Noahide law, where there are basically good slaves and bad slaves. It's a two-tiered legal system, one law for Jews, one law for everyone else. You have no private property. You have no rights if you are a non-Jew. And the Kennedy family came out of that European Catholic background, you know, family-oriented value systems, hard work, very clever people, and worked hard and were successful and were systematically destroyed for it. So if you'd like to join us in the chat room, you can come out to bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. That's bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. And like we always do, we either start out at the end of the Ice Age and start at the beginning of the Great Year, or we start at the end start at the beginning of the Piscean Age. And so tonight we're going to, of course, start at there, the Piscean Age. So think of 70 AD, the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed. And like I always stress to you on the show, that war between Jerusalem and the Jews and Rome never ended. You know, get that through your head, that the war against the Gentiles between the Jews and everybody else, be it the Persians, be it the Egyptians, be it Rome, be it the Greeks. The Jews feel they have to be the absolute masters of everyone and that we exist only to serve them. So that war with Rome never ended. And so you can imagine how much these hardcore Jews, these Jewish supremacists, completely despise successful Catholics and Protestants or anyone else, but especially Roman Catholics. And the Kennedy family just really were the American royalty, if you will. And they always, I grew up with the idea of the Kennedys and the John Kennedy's administration, and they called it Camelot. And just that idea of we were going to move into the next century and we were going to go into space and we were going to do these wonderful things. And instead, we have entered on this path of this dystopian nightmare. And so where did that come from? And what are the players involved? What are the strategies? What are the end games? So let's just walk through this. So again, you know, 70 AD, the temple's destroyed. 135 AD, Jerusalem was destroyed and Jews were prohibited from the city. That was the beginning of the diaspora. And we know that everywhere the Jews went, they eventually got thrown out. And they always play the eternal innocent victim rather than acknowledging why their actions and deeds and behavior got them thrown out of all of these places around the world. Now, in 180, Irenaeus composed the first official Christian Bible of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So this was the beginning of the foundations of Christianity, which would go on to shape Western civilization for 2,000 years. In 306 AD, Constantine was proclaimed emperor of the Roman Empire. And in 313, Constantine declared Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire. In 732, Charles Martel stopped the Muslim invasion at the Pyrenees Mountains in between Spain and France. His son, Charlemagne, was crowned emperor of the Holy Roman Empire by Pope Leo III in 800 AD. Of course, in 1066, you had the Norman invasion, and then in 1099, the Priory of Zion was formed. Now, this was that movement of Jews throughout Christendom, where sometimes they would be openly Jews, other times they would pretend to be Christian, and this was what they called crypto-Jews, and so a lot of your history where they talk about Frenchmen or Englishmen or Germans, no, they were Jews living in France, Jews living in England, Jews living in Germany, etc. And so the Priory of Zion was formed by Jewish people that had moved in to that area of France, and some were openly being Jewish, others were being crypto. And then 1118 AD, the Knight Templars were founded. Now again, you know, the Templars were made up of the two groups, Jewish and Christians, that were being basically manipulated by the Priory of Zion. So the Knights Templars became the collection agency basically for the Priory of Zion, and this was your first international banking type cartel syndicates that totally devastated Europe. This was, you know, the big push to usury. It's all based on the creation of money out of nothing and interest, compound interest, and which is the foundation of Jewish economics. It's all about defining money as debt, because you can use debt to control people. That psychological idea of, you know, being in debt, that you owe somebody, that is where that power of usury comes from, that the magic numbers on the spreadsheet means that if you don't pay your bills, we can take all your real assets, and you signed a contract. And that idea of the contract is so key to that Jewish mindset. And, of course, you know, the Templars were shut down by the church. Many were imprisoned, executed, but many disappeared with the fleet. And that foundation of the Templars, though, became the basis of Freemasonry. There's so much similarities between the way the Knights Templars are organized and the way Freemasonry and all the different orders of Freemasonry are organized. Now, in 1738... the Catholic Church prohibited Catholics from membership in any type of Masonic organization. And they had various reasons for doing this. You know, one of the big ones was Masonic burial versus Catholic last rites. But there were, you know, many other things about Freemasonry, which is very much in contrast to church interpretation of the Gospels, because all of these orders are based on the Jewish Talmudic system and the Old Testament and the Torah. And also, we talk about on this show, the things that the Knights Templars found when they dug under the Temple Mount when they returned in 1126. You know, the stuff they found was basically those old copper era, we talk about on the show, systems of debt management. And so the idea of using usury and all the vices that went along with it, the church said, you know, we don't want that. And Freemasonry is rife with this. And so when you read, you know, you really get into Freemasonry, you realize just how different a system it is to the system of Christianity. And so this beginning in 1738 until 1983, the church considered, you know, Masonic activity as being grounds for automatic excommunication. Now, when you think about, you know, the mind of the church, when you were excommunicated, that not only meant that you had to leave the body of the church here, but it also damned you to eternal hell in church doctrine, you know. And so Pope Clement in 1738, Benedict the 14th in 1751, Pius the 7th in 1821, and then in 1825 was the Key Gravera. And this basically says to condemn them in such a way that it would be impossible to claim exemption from the condemnation. Basically, that once you took that blood oath of a Freemason, then you were not redeemable anymore. That you had basically, you know, sinned so much that you can't be redeemed. And this is just how serious the church saw Freemasonry. Now, we don't think about that today because under Vatican II and all these other things, especially after 1983, where the Catholic Church completely changed its stance on Freemasonry, where now priests are out there promoting Freemasonry, that's not how it used to be. And so it's from that polarization of Freemasons versus Catholic that a lot of this history of the Kennedy family makes more sense. So, like I said, that was 1825. Well, in 1823, a man by the name of Patrick Kennedy was born in New Ross County, Wexford, Ireland. And in 1824, a young lady by the name of Bridget Murphy was born in the same place. They got married, and then in 1845... to 1852 is when you had the Great Famine in Ireland, sometimes referred to as the Potato Famine. Now, there's been some really good research on that period on whether or not that famine was organic or synthetic. And I've seen a lot of really good data that says that that was not an organic event, that that was a contrived event, one of the first uses of bioweapons, if you will, against a population of that wonderful Jewish tactic of starving people to death as a weapon. We saw the same thing in the Holodomor, where millions of people were starved to death through synthetic introduced famine conditions. And so it's that event that led them to come to the United States, which was in its golden era of the Great Experiment. So 1849, Patrick Kennedy and Bridget Ross married in Boston, Massachusetts. In 1858, Patrick Joseph, or P.J. Kennedy, was born in Boston, Mass. Now, his older brother, John, had died of cholera 2 years before, and his father died 10 months after PJ was born. And that gives you an idea of the conditions of that time, that you could die in Boston from cholera, and it was just widespread. And so PJ, as he was known, Patrick Joseph, began working on the docks to support the family at the age of 14, and was one of those people that had that magic combination of being a hard, dependable worker, one of those people that everybody just liked. You know, he was just a very sociable person and was very clever with money. And so he managed to save and invest. And at the time of his death, he owned 3 saloons and a whiskey import house, and had major holdings in coal and banking interests. So right there, you should see a red flag with an Irish Catholic family having those type of assets, because we see that the Jews think that they're supposed to be in charge of all the alcohol, all the vice, if you will, and all the banking and all the industry. And so you can see that in the New World, we've always had these two factions battling with each other. You know, that idea of the Christians coming over with their animals and their tools and their books and their Bibles and their families to start the great experiment, you know, to build a new world, whereas the Jews came over with their slaves and their plantations to basically build a Jewish model. So there's always been this battle for the soul of America, if you will, and or soul of the New World. And the great experiment flew in the face of the Jewish aspirations for the New World, because they wanted a master-slave system like their plantation models. And that's one of the big things you have to learn is, you know, who was bringing the slaves to the New World? And it wasn't the, you know, Christians coming across with their families. You know, you don't see the slaves on the Mayflower. You know, they didn't bring slaves over. They brought, you know, livestock, tools, and building materials and those kind of things. So PJ was just a model of the success story of working in a type of society where the government did not take care of you, but you were free to go as far as you could possibly go, and nobody would stand, you know, the government wouldn't stifle you down like the old world model, the old European model. You know, you didn't have to be born into royalty to have something, in other words. You know, it was not the feudal model. It was like you could go and build something, and the idea of families working together to build something was so key to the great experiment. And then in 1884, P.J. Kennedy was elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives, and he served five consecutive one-year terms. So, you know, you think that somebody could start out working on the docks, and within the time that he, you know, matured into a man of the community, could enter in and be successful in politics. And so he served five consecutive one-year terms, and then followed by 3 2-year terms in the Massachusetts Senate. So, you know, moving from, you know, that local politics, and this is the way the family systems worked, is, you know, you started out in local politics, and you just, then regional politics, and then state politics, and then national or federal level politics. That was the model. And so, again, the Kennedy family is that success story of starting out small and building up your support base and your networks. And by, you know, in by the time of 1884, he had established himself as one of the principal Democratic leaders in Massachusetts. And so, like I said, he was just an amazing person. In 1888, he was invited to give one of the seconding speeches for Grover Cleveland at the Democratic National Convention in St. Louis. So that was his first taste of the national stage, if you will, was in 1888. In 1887, P.J. married Mary Augusta Hickey, and they had 4 children. Now, what's interesting, who was Joseph, you know, the 4 children were Joseph Patrick or Joe Kennedy, Francis Benedict Kennedy, Mary Loretta Kennedy, and Margaret Louise Kennedy. Now, Francis Benedict, his younger, Joseph's younger brother, died at a very young age, leaving Joe Kennedy as the only son of the family. So PJ put all of his aspirations into Joe Kennedy. And so Joe Kennedy was born in 1888, which was the same year that PJ gave the seconding speech for Grover Cleveland. So that was a big year for him, that, you know, he got a son and he got to introduce the president of the United States, who would become the president of the United States. Now, because of PJ's hard work, Joseph Kennedy had the means to go to better schools. And so he attended the Boston Latin School and was elected class president and played on the baseball team. So again, Joe Kennedy was, like his father, one of those people that was very clever, very good with money, and people liked him, and people liked to do business with him. You know, there's been a lot of propaganda about Joe Kennedy, you know, being such a swindler, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, when you try to look at the sources of that, it doesn't pan out. And I think, you know, we talk about in the Breakfast Club, our thinkers, our stinkers, and our sinkers, you know, things that are information, misinformation, and disinformation. And I think a lot of the attacks on Joe Kennedy come from the Jewish media, of, and it's just total disinformation and propaganda to, you know, demonize him because they didn't like him because he was competition. And so, but the people, you know, around him obviously liked him because he rose up. You know, his father set the path and he went further. So he went to Harvard College. He was a member of the Hastings Puddings Club, which was no easy feat at the time or today. He was a member of the Delta Upsilon fraternity, whose motto is Justice, Our Foundation. And he also played on the baseball team. In 1914, Joe Kennedy married Rose Elizabeth Fitzgerald. And what's key there is the Fitzgerald family at the time was his father's leading rival family. So that was one of those marriages that united two very, very powerful rival clans into one unified clan, the Kennedys and the Fitzgeralds. And so Rose Elizabeth Fitzgerald and Joe Kennedy got married in 1914. And she was the eldest daughter of Boston Mayor John F. or Honey Fitz Fitzgerald. Now, they had nine children. So in 1915, they had Joseph Patrick Jr., John Fitzgerald, Rosemarie or Rosemary, and that was in 1918. 1920, they had Kathleen Agnes. In 1921, they had Eunice Mary. In 1924, Patricia Helen. And in 1925, Robert Francis. And in 1928, Jean Ann. And in 1932, Edward Moore, otherwise known as Joe, Jack, Rosemary, Kick, Mary, Pat, Bobby, Jean Ann, and Ted, or Teddy. Okay? And so here you have four sons of Joe Kennedy. You had Joe Jr., Jack, Bobby, and Ted. And these four would go on to have a very, it's hard to describe, it's like eventful lives. Some people, you know, talk about the Kennedy curse, and it's like, well, who curses people? You know, especially the competition. But to the Jewish cabal that's trying to do world Zionism, the world communism, the Kennedy family obviously stood out as a major threat, because they were such players in so many areas of politics and banking, manufacturing, mining, you know, utilities, etc. So it was at this time that the, you know, Joe Kennedy's family is getting established, that you had the Jews launching their world Zionist agenda. And we talk about how, you know, the first world Zionist Congress was held in Theodore Herzl in the end of the, you know, the 1800s, you know, 1896, you know, they met and they had their plans for taking over the world and establishing Israel and destroying all the best Gentiles to get rid of all the white people. And this was, you know, part of the plan. You know, we're considered Amalek to the Jews. And so, in 1915, you know, we had the Young Turks coup d'etat, which were the Jewish Dome that were trying to infiltrate and corrupt the Ottoman Empire to soften up the area that they are going to move into in Palestine, which was at the time part of the Ottoman Empire. So the first step was to destabilize Turkey with the Young Turks' Dome coup d'etat. Then, of course, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 in Russia. And the Kennedys were very aware of the world stage. You know, they were very worldly, very well traveled. So they knew all about the World Zionist Movement. They knew about these communist revolutions taking apart around the world. And they knew that they were a target. Now, it's interesting that the Jews in America were playing this game on the international stage because they also had lots of power because in 1913 they had managed to establish the Federal Reserve that removed the banking system from the U.S. government. So now we had a private Jewish bank loaning, you know, creating money out of thin air and loaning it to the American people, putting us in debt. And this was part of the battle of the Kennedy family, was they saw the threat the Federal Reserve posed to their banking interest. They understood all of the math of what Jewish banking meant and that it was a threat. But at the same time, the Jews were really playing this cooperation game even back then, you know, that they're always looking out for all the minorities and cooperating as long as they're leading the groups. And so in 1927, a group called the National Conference for Christians and Jews was founded. And this was supposedly a group of Jews, Protestants, and Catholics that were going to, you know, establish all these interfaith dialogues and, you know, have tolerance for everybody. And it's interesting that in the 1990s, this group rebranded itself as the National Conference for Community and Justice. And they're the same group that's running around these college campuses doing all these anytown psychological warfare operations posed as workshops where they bring in these white kids and kids, you know, people of color, and proceed to shame the white kids for their white privilege and enrage all the people of color against the white kids for having the white privilege. And it's put in the playlist, also in the chat room this week, several of their videos. And it's amazing to watch these so-called adult leaders take these impressionable youths into these week-long leadership training camps and completely brainwash them. And so definitely check some of that material out. But you know, they started up back in 1927 by calling themselves the National Conference for Christians and Jews. And it was, you know, again, that Protestant, Catholic, and Jew cooperation. But of course, the Jews are the ones controlling it, just like the NAACP and all these other organizations and Black Lives Matter. You know, there's always a Jew behind that. So in the other aspect of this was in 1931, there was a nationwide purge of all the old Vice crime bosses. Now, before this coup, Vice in the United States basically meant prostitution, gambling, and during Prohibition, alcohol sales. Well, after that is when you got complete Jewish domination of all the so-called organized crime. And what was telling about the 1931 coup was that it happened on September 11th, and it was led by Lucky Luciano, and it was one of those nationwide hits where it was just the amount of planning and coordination and secrecy involved with something this massive happening without anybody leaking it. And that just shows you how well the hidden hand operates, because they know, the Jew knows, that if they ever leak anything and break the Jewish Masorah law, that their family and they are just dead. They're done for. And so the hidden hand, you know, has been able to do these kind of operations, just like 9/11 and other assassinations around the world, because of their ability to act together against the Gentiles. And that's the big thing. The mindset is it's us against them, and you know, the stupid goyim, and we're the superior Jews. So that led to the 1934 meeting in Kansas City, Missouri, between Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky. And basically it was the surviving bosses who were given the option of either come to work for us or we'll kill you and your families. And that was the foundation of what they called the Syndicate or Murder Incorporated. So 1934 is basically in the United States when you had this Jewish underground coup d'etat of all vice. And then suddenly it got into the dark areas of the drugs, white slavery, and just the dark, dark side that we know exists today in that Jewish organized crime model that exists around the world. But that was key in the United States in 1934. Now, it was during this time that Joe Kennedy was supporting Franklin D. Roosevelt's campaign. So from 1932 to 1935, Joe Kennedy was heavily supportive of Franklin D. Roosevelt. And then in 1934, Congress established the Securities Exchange Commission to clean up Wall Street. And this was interesting because up until that time, things like insider trading weren't against the law. And that was part of why you had the necessity and business of networking, because it was through your networking that you would know where the business ventures were going, which businesses were having problems, etc., where you knew how to invest your money. Well, after 1934, all of that became illegal. And that was, you know, when you begin to have the idea of insider trading as, you know, something that was enforceable by law. And Joe Kennedy was put in charge of that. And one of the complaints against him at the time was, you know, you're enforcing laws now against us, and you did the same thing to make your fortune. You know, that you are now saying, do as I say, not as I do. And that, so that is one of the transitions in how business was done in the United States, especially in investing on the New York Stock Exchange. Now, in 1934 is also when Father Charles Coughlin was doing his radio show outside of Detroit, and he was very, very critical. First, he supported FDR, but then he really got very critical of FDR, very critical of communism, and was supporting the Germans, you know, the National Socialist Germany under Adolf Hitler. Coughlin was very supportive of that because he saw what the Bolsheviks had done to Russia. And this started causing friction. And so Joe Kennedy was brought in to try to act as a mediator, if you will, between FDR and Father Coughlin. And yeah, this got Father Coughlin in trouble with the church at that time, because he was so outspoken. And what's interesting to me now with these ears, when I go back and listen to some of those programs, I totally get what he's saying, and that he was very, very spot on with so much of his analysis at the time. It was just politically incorrect for the time, especially with the FDR administration. In 1938, Joe Kennedy was appointed to the ambassador of the United Kingdom. Now, he worked very hard to try to improve relationships between the UK and Germany, and also the US and Germany. In 1934, Joe Sr. sent Joe Jr. to Germany to study the National Socialist model. And Joe Jr. was just amazed with what they had done, because he understood World War I. He understood the Treaty of Versailles and how the Jews had manipulated it to destroy the German people. And he was very, very favorable of what the National Socialists were doing. And at the time, so was Joe Sr. And so Joe Sr. worked very, very hard to try to stop the war between the UK and Germany, but also to try to keep the US out of the war. And that, of course, put him at odds with the American Jews that wanted the United States into the war, because they were doing that grand chessboard, World War II, just like they had done World War I with the Balfour Agreement, that, you know, if you give us Palestine, we'll get the Americans into World War I to save England from Germany. You know, that was basically what happened with the Balfour Declaration, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary. And so Joe Kennedy was stuck in the middle of that. So you can imagine how much the Jewish power system in America, in the city of London, and around the world, the communists, all really hated him and saw him as an obstacle and saw his children as threats. It was in 1941, the key point is that when Germany began aerial bombing of England in September 1940, Joe Sr. had to really back off of his support of Germany as his role of the UK ambassador. In 1941, Theodore Newman Kaufman writes, "Germany must perish." And if you've never seen that book, I mean, it's amazing that was the kind of hate that the Jews had towards the Germans. They wanted the Germans destroyed, just like they destroyed the Russians in the Bolshevik Revolution. Germany was next, and then they're going for, you know, I guess you could say they did England first by invading, setting up the city of London, and Rothschild taking over after Napoleon's loss. But then, you know, destroying Russia, they wanted to destroy Germany, and now they want to destroy the United States and Canada. But, you know, 1941, Kaufman puts out "Germany Must Perish," and it was full genocide. He was calling for, you know, German men to be sterilized and things like that. And it was at this time that Joe Jr. became an outspoken critic of FDR's third term, because that was unprecedented in the Great Experiment, because part of the model was you did not want leaders for life. We did, you know, the Great Experiment, you didn't want a king that, you know, ruled till their death. You wanted people to serve specific terms of office, and then they had to go do something else. So you could do a congressman for so many years, you could be a senator for so many years, you could be president for so many years, but that was it. You couldn't do multiple terms of these offices. And so when, under the idea of we're under a state of national emergency, the Great Depression, etc., you want to keep the existing administration in place, Joe Jr. became very, very outspoken against that. And that also divided the Kennedys from the Franklin D. Roosevelt's power system. Then in 1944, Joe Kennedy was invested as a Knight of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, which is an order of the church that very few Americans were a member. And so that was a very high honor, but also fueled that Catholic Protestant distrust in the American psyche. And that was part of the problem with Catholics in the Great Experiment, is do they have loyalty to the Constitution or do they have loyalty to the Pope? And so being a Knight of Malta also put him at odds with people that had that anti-Catholic sentiment at the time. Now, when we look at this children, Joe Jr., John F. Kennedy or Jack Kennedy Robert Kennedy or Bobby Kennedy and Edward Kennedy or Ted Kennedy, each one of those went on to have horrible experiences and their pursuit of political office in, you know, the Great Experiment. And you can tell that there was a shift in the United States at that time, that, you know, suddenly it felt like the Great Experiment wasn't working anymore, that something had gone wrong. And this is, I think, when people really started to have questions about, instead of our government, it suddenly became the government. And the line from Rothschild always comes to mind, where he says, let me print a nation's money and I care not who makes its laws. And that was so key. You know, 1913, once we lost the power to print and coin our own money, we were a slave to Jewish private central bankers. And so, you know, whoever has the power of the purse controls the nation, and anybody who fights that has to be slapped down. And so suddenly the game rules changed in 1913. And so you had this family that was on its ascendancy that was suddenly being smacked down by that hidden hand. So Joe Jr., I think, is one of the most interesting stories that nobody ever talks about. Of course, you know, everybody knows about President Kennedy being assassinated in Dallas and all the various conspiracies surrounding that. But Joe Jr., you know, he was the firstborn son, and he was the one that Joe Sr. thought was going to be the first president of the, or the first Catholic president of the United States. And that was what he was being groomed for. So, it's amazing to me that he's like the forgotten son, and his death, I think, rings as much, if not the same, as John Kennedy's and Robert Kennedy's open assassination. So, let's, you know, he was born in 1915. He attended Dexter School in Brooklyn, Mass., and he graduated in 1933 from the Choate School in Wallingford, Connecticut. In 1934, like we talked about, his father sent him to Germany. And when you read what he wrote back about his analysis of what the Germans were doing with National Socialism, you could tell that he was totally amazed that, you know, this is what we need to do in the United States. That was, you know, the vibe you get when you read his letters and memoirs, etc. In 1938, he graduated Harvard. He played rugby, football, and crew. So he was not a pansy by any means. You know, he was a man's man kind of guy, you know, playing rugby and football. And then he was on the student council. He enrolled in Harvard Law School. In 1940, he was the delegate to the Democratic Convention and planned to run for the Massachusetts 11th District in 46. But then in December 7th, 1941, is when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. And so everybody's life plan suddenly took a change. And so in 1941, before his final year at Harvard Law School, he enlisted in the U.S. Naval Reserve Flight School as a naval aviator. So again, you know, the guy was amazing. You know, football star, and was a trained military pilot. Or excuse me, aviator. Naval guys hate it when you call them pilots. They're aviators. In May 1942, he's commissioned as a Navy ensign. In 1943, he was sent to Britain. In 1944, he became a member of the Bomber Squadron 110, Special Air Unit 1. So this was a special ops group that he was with. And they were doing radio-controlled planes under this top-secret program back then. The problem with the technology at the time was they couldn't get the planes to take off by themselves, and you didn't land them. Basically, you loaded them full of explosives and crashed them into the target and, you know, to detonate the explosions via radio control. And so what you would do is you had these Top Gun aviators and pilots that would take off the plane, you know, get it on its path, and then before it got into the battle theater, they would parachute out, and the plane would then be controlled by remote control, and the ordnance would be detonated by remote control. And July 1st, 1941, he was promoted to lieutenant. And even though he had done his 25 missions and was eligible to return home, he volunteered for an operation called Operation Aphrodite. And the way the story goes, and this is one of the, you know, this was classified for years, and there's parts of this that still haven't been released, and there's so much speculation, but on 12th of August, 1944, he took off. Everything was going great. They had tons of explosives on the plane. They had taken off fine. They had gotten to their cruising altitude. They had their spotter planes behind them filming everything, and the controlling planes. Everything tested out fine. And part of the procedure was you did not arm the munitions until you were in flight, because there was a possibility that during takeoff something could go wrong. So you always kept the munitions unarmed during takeoff, and then once your cruising altitude was established, you would then arm the munitions and then parachute out of the plane. The radio control guys would take over and then detonate over the target. Well, they armed the munitions, and he sent the code word of spade flush to say, that was the code to say that the munitions had been armed, and they were supposed to have several minutes to leave the aircraft, and then another signal would detonate. But suddenly the plane exploded, killing him instantly. And this was, of course, hushed up, and there was just lots of speculation, and a lot of people have done a lot of really good work to say that it was not an accident, because those systems were tested, retested, you know, checked before takeoff. You know, everything was fine. It was one of those, you know, nobody could have messed up, so it had to be somebody sending the detonate code early. But the question was, who did that? And what, you know, so who benefited from this particular person being killed before he could return back to the United States, a war hero, and like people like Eisenhower, have a shot at the White House? So, you know, definitely if you're interested, do some research down that alley, because there's a lot of good nuggets that I found over the years on that. Now, with, you know, Jack Kennedy, of course, you know, we all know the story of him, and with Dallas and the CIA and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and also the relationship with Israel. You know, so much points to his work to make sure that Israel did not have a nuclear program, despite all the other things he did with Israel. You know, I did not realize that it was John F. Kennedy that came up with the term in his dealings with Golda Meir to establish the special relationship with Israel. That term, special relationship, that came from John Kennedy. You know, it's like who benefited from Kennedy being assassinated and Johnson taking over. And also, you know, the whole Vietnam thing, the demoralization of turning the youth against the government that was going on, the amount of cultural Marxism that was infiltrating through the Columbia School from the Frankfurt School, the so-called New Left that was infiltrating the Democratic Party and running all the old Democrats out by any means necessary. So instead of Kennedy's, suddenly you've got Clinton's and Obama's and Rahm Emanuel's and those kind of guys. Just like with the Republicans, you had the neocons who were the Richard Pearls, the Paul Wolfowitzes, you know, the William Crystals, you know, those kind of people. And it's like basically the Jews infiltrating both parties and taking them over and running all the old party members out. Now, Bobby Kennedy was the attorney general during the Kennedy administration, and he went after organized crime big time. And we know from, you know, the big coup of 34 with Meyer Lansky and Murder Incorporated who that was. That, you know, basically the Kennedy administration was going after Jewish organized crime, and under his attorney general position, convictions against organized crime rose 800%. And when LBJ announced that he was not going to seek a second term in office, Bobby Kennedy announced that he was going to run and was doing great in all the primaries. And then in June 5th, 1968, at the ballroom in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, California, he was gunned down. And the person that they said did it was, of course, the Palestinian Sirhan Sirhan. So that should immediately raise flags that, you know, something else happened. And all the ballistics tests, you know, proved that the official story of that assassination, just like JFK's assassination, was physically impossible. Dallas, the official story is physically impossible. RFK's assassination, completely physically impossible. And one of the interesting things of the Bobby Kennedy assassination is the story of the woman in the polka dot dress who came running out saying, "We killed him, we did it, we killed him." And so do some research on that, of, you know, the woman in the polka dot dress. That is such a bizarre story, but it just really shows that there was this cabal within the Democratic Party that was working for another interest. And so also telling is his bodyguards at the time were NFL football player Rosie Greer and the Olympic star Rafer Johnson. And you can tell how their stories went, that there was always something wrong with the way they tell what happened. And one thing, it kept changing over the years. And, you know, just that there was just more to that Kennedy assassination than the official story. Then, of course, Ted Kennedy was born in 1932. And he died in 2009. He was sworn into the U.S. Senate for the senator from Massachusetts in 62. And he had political aspirations to go for the presidency. But then in July 18th, 1969, was the infamous Chappaquiddick Island incident at Martha's Vineyard, where he was hosting a party for the Boiler Room Girls who had been working his brother Bobby's campaign a year earlier. And the woman, Mary Jo Kopeschke, was found dead in his car. Now, he was a front runner for the 1972 Democratic nomination for president up to that time. And that's one of those stories that, you know, it just doesn't hold water the way it all went down. And so many people think that the mob, you know, the Jewish mob basically set him up to take him out. And it's interesting, the released Nixon tapes talk about this, that, you know, Nixon describes that, you know, Ted Kennedy did not know what he was really getting into and what he was going up against and how these people played, meaning the Jews. And that's one of the things about President Nixon was, you know, he was very aware of the JQ and the JP in the United States, and they demonized him for it. Now, what's interesting about Ted Kennedy, when he finally died in 2009, he was granted an honorary knighthood by Queen Elizabeth II of the UK. That was one of those things that really rubbed a lot of Americans wrong, because, you know, that was part of the separation between, you know, we left England to form the United States on a different model, and that our people should not be knighted by royalty. But yet he was given a knighthood by Queen Elizabeth upon his death. So that's interesting. And of course, the last Kennedy to die tragically that I want to talk about was, of course, John Jr., who was born in 1960, and he died in 1999. And he put out in 1995 a magazine called George, which is a very interesting magazine that was really trying to do investigative reporting. And then when 1998, when Senator Daniel Patrick McConaughey announced his retirement, lots of people threw in their hat, and he was one of the people that everybody thought would be prime candidate. And in July 16th, 1999 is when he took off in his airplane with his wife and his sister-in-law from New Jersey on his way to Martha's Vineyard, and the plane suddenly went down. And it was, again, one of those, you know, clear nights, should have been no problems, but a very suspicious small craft plane crash. And also telling is, when they recovered the bodies, they did a real quick autopsy and then cremated them rather than burying them. This, of course, paved the way for Hillary Clinton to take that Senate seat. And also, Bill Clinton was president at the time, and he played a very interesting role in the so-called investigation of what happened. So that's basically, you know, kind of a 10,000-foot view of the Kennedy family. And so you can see that, you know, this is, you know, this battle that has been going on since 70 AD, and part of the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, says, kill the best Gentiles. And I can think of very few families that typify that idea of the great experiment success story as the Kennedy family did. And by Jewish law, they became a target and were taken out. And it's a very sad story of U.S. history. But that is where we are in the current year political system. So with that said, you've been listening to Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club, and I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. And until next time, I hope everyone has a wonderful week and a wonderful evening, and I will see you all at the rendezvous.